that kind of influence and could not be bought, not at this stage, not after 15 years of doing environmental radio shows as a labor of love, and that labor of love continues today. I'm very pleased to have my co-host D.R. Tucker joining me for at least the first segment because we have a very special guest, one of the world's leading experts on climate change, Professor Kerry Emanuel of MIT. He is a professor of atmospheric science there. I believe he's on sabbatical this year, so especially want to welcome you, Professor Emanuel, for taking time out. I think you're up there in Maine, probably trying to get away from climate change and all the reminders that we're going in the wrong direction. So we really, especially during the holiday season, really appreciate you taking time out.
It's my pleasure. We're just digging out up here in Maine from some quite a bit of snow.
Yes, unseasonal, or would you say it is about what you'd expect this time of year? And speaking of unseasonal, by the way, I live in Northern California. We had 66 degrees yesterday, and having grown up in the Bay Area, I don't think it's ever been that warm in December, late December anyway.
Sounds nice to me.
I'm sure, but, you know, I don't love it that much because we know what this portends for our children. But let's talk about, first of all, D.R. Tucker, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, thanks, D.R. I just want to get your overall view, Professor Emanuel, of the sort of highlights and lowlights from 2013 before we drill down and get too specific. A lot's happened. Certainly Mother Nature has given us more than enough reasons to be concerned, ranging from a year ago with Sandy to the typhoon in the Philippines to more Oklahoma being, you know, splintered pretty much by record-breaking tornado, typhoon, whatever you want to call it. And what is the difference by the typhoons?
The difference between typhoons and hurricanes, is that what you asked?
Yes, that's one of the questions. You don't have to start with that, but that is one of the things I've wondered about myself. And
okay.
Who better than you to explain this and more? So thank you for being with us again, and I'm going to...
Sure. Well, we try to look at things more on sort of decadal to century time scales when we look for climate change. And, of course, the extreme events can be the canaries in the mine of climate change in the sense that you see changes in the tails of the distribution sometimes before you see them in the means. But you have to be careful to look at the actual statistics of them. And I spend a lot of time looking at the statistics of hurricanes, which, by the way, are the same things as typhoons. They're just different names for the same phenomena. And we do see some evidence that the distributions are shifting away from weaker storms and toward more intense ones. They're not necessarily more storms on the planet. In fact, we expect the weaker storms actually to decline. But the storms that are destructive, like Haiyan, there is some evidence primarily from satellite data that we're seeing an increased incidence of that level of intensity event there, and that's a matter of concern. And that's consistent with what just about every group who studied the problem of hurricanes and climate has agreed upon, which is that the frequency of highly intense hurricanes, Category 3 and above, should increase with global temperature. Even while some of the weaker category storms, which tend to dominate the numbers of events, may actually decline. The other thing that we agree on is that rainfall from hurricanes, typhoons, and so forth should go up. We see this happening. We see, of course, that most of the heat, as predicted by models, is going into the oceans. The oceans absorb a lot more heat than the atmosphere, and the mean temperature of the oceans continues to go up. We haven't seen any leveling off of that, and so it continues.
Professor Emanuel, there was certainly a storm of coverage, so to speak, of an open letter that you and Professor James Hansen and Dr. James Hansen wrote last month concerning the use of nuclear power as the necessary means to get us to a low carbon future. What do you say to nuclear skeptics like myself who are filled with fears of Fukushima? How would you reassure those of us who are skittish about nuclear energy that it is in fact the necessary step in order to get to a low carbon or carbon free future?
So I think the answer to that is fairly straightforward. The signers of that letter are all in favor of developing renewables like solar and wind But solar and wind are variable in time and in space, and you will always need a base load, that is a backup that runs 24/7. And the real issue is, what is that backup source? It can't be all renewables, or at least not the renewables we know about, because of their it's difficult to scale them up quickly, and they're not on 24/7. You always need that base load source. And the real issue is that base load source going to be carbon-based, or will it be something else? And the only real alternative is nuclear. So we're not kidding ourselves about the risks of nuclear. They're there. But those have to be weighed against the risks of the kinds of energy sources that they would replace. So let's take coal. I mean, coal is conservatively estimated to result in about 100,000 premature deaths globally a year. And if you take the worst nuclear accidents that we've had, tally them all up, we're talking about literally a handful of people. They just can't be compared. To the extent that you replace coal with nuclear, you're replacing something dirty and dangerous with something that's relatively clean and safe. Is it absolutely clean and absolutely safe? No, nothing is. Not even wind farms are absolutely clean and safe. So it's a question of relative risk.
It seems like we're in such a jam. I mean, that's a small word for a big worldwide problem, and that is with what we saw happen in Japan and Fukushima and the fallout, and especially here on the West Coast, people concerned about there being a cover-up, about the impacts of radiation, you know, on marine life and therefore seafood and just what might be in the air, all kinds of reports about that. But looking at what Mother Nature is doing in terms of making, you know, her rage, if we can, you know, attribute a human element to Mother Nature, you know, in terms of all the extreme weather events. It seems that by putting off these really important discussions and decisions about our energy future, and by sort of ignoring energy policy in this country going forward, that we're really pushing things to the brink and kind of up against the wall. Do you sense that, as someone who has been an expert in this area for years, and I'm sure in your own way, many ways, have been trying to get people to pay attention to this, both at the top in Washington and just the general public across America?
I do sense that, but I also sense a slow change of tide on this issue, and more and more people, I think, are coming to understand that there is a problem, that we do need to solve it for the sake of future generations. And what my colleagues and I are trying to do is to at least shift the debate away from, do we have a problem, because clearly we do, or we have a set of risks that we're confronting, to a debate over how you actually solve the problem. If we had the major political parties debating with each other about, well, whether we're going to go nuclear or solar or wind or what mix of those things, we would be in a much better situation than the debate that we seem to still be having about whether there's any risk to deal with at all.
Or more accurately, the website of Obamacare, going on and on and on in terms of taking up precious time focused on the healthcare reform initiative, which is now going into the fifth year. But that's another story. I completely agree that we should be having these very important debates and discussions, not only, you know, every day, but at the top of the political, you know, pyramid, and also throughout the mainstream media. We just got a report from FAIR, just came out today, looking at, once again, the pretty dismal connecting of the dots in mainstream media, how they covered all the extreme weather we saw in 2013, because it, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and the TV equivalent to bleeds is showing damaged buildings and people in distress and human suffering. But all too often, the link to likely climate change was not made by the major networks. How big of a problem do you think that is, the lack of really taking this on as a serious issue by many of our news networks and mainstream platforms?
Well, it's hard to know how much of a problem it is. It's also maybe generational. I'm reading at the moment about the lead-up to the American involvement in the Second World War. And, you know, in the 1930s, it was fairly clear that serious problems were developing in Western Europe and in Japan. And but most Americans, really, understandably, because they had very recently fought another world war, tried to to avoid even talking about it. They certainly didn't want to get involved. And Roosevelt, who saw the long-term existential threat of Nazism and that particular problem, had a very difficult time persuading Americans to take this seriously, to actually do something about it. He was very frustrated until Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor changed everything. I think that's sort of the way it works. You know, it's a problem that, in the case of World War II, was 3,000 or 4,000 miles away across the ocean. It's somebody else's problem. It's not so different from saying, well, this is a problem that's 50 or 100 years off. It's not my problem, right? It's not until the bomb falls on your house or on the house of somebody in your country that you wake up and you say, yeah, maybe it's here and it's now. And I don't know what our Pearl Harbor will be, but there probably will be one.
Speaking of the discussion that you mentioned about the need for solutions, one of the reasons it's hard to have such a discussion is because so much of our media has been contaminated by the voices of climate denialists. You have wrote a great letter to the editor in the Boston Globe on December the 11th, responding to the libertarian ideologue who writes for the Globe, whose name I will not mention. I will not, contaminate our show by mentioning his name, in response to some of the claptrap he wrote. And not only that, we also have the current continuing controversy over the presence of David Koch on the board of trustees of WGBH, the PBS affiliate in Boston. At what point will we finally see mainstream media sort of get rid of this false balance? I mean, you see not only in the two venues I mentioned, but also with CNN bringing on people like Mark Morano and Bourne Lomborg to sort of confuse the issue and muddy the rising waters about the issue. At what point will the media finally give up on doing this sort of false balance and finally give the sort of straight scoop on the issue?
I think the point at which they change tactics is when they hear enough from their viewers or their readers in protest to it that they realize that it's not selling like it used to sell. And so how do you bring about that change? Well, I think that change is very slowly occurring naturally. And there's an analog, and I'm sure you're aware of this. I know you've talked about it, which is the campaign by the tobacco industry to persuade Americans that there really wasn't much of a health risk to cigarette smoking. And it was very successful for a while. I mean, between when science was quite sure that there was a link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer, which dates all the way back into the earlier mid-1950s, and the time when per capita smoking actually started to decline in the 1980s, you're talking about 30 years. What happened? I mean, there was this vigorous campaign by the industry to persuade people that there really wasn't much risk. And what I think turned the tide is when enough people knew new smokers who were suffering or dying, when your grandmother died from lung cancer, when your great aunt died from lung cancer, you started seeing these things happening. You started questioning all of this propaganda. And that house of cards, when it falls, tends to fall fairly quickly. And so I think when American people see for themselves the effects of climate change, when they're actually persuaded as individuals, yeah, what the scientists have been telling us actually seems to be happening, that's the point where they're not going to tolerate from their own media this false balance idea.
Well, we will get off the topic of media, even though we do focus on it a lot on this show, as regular listeners may know. But, Jane Velez-Mitchell recently of Headline News got somehow very worked up, appropriately, about the fact that we humans are, in part to blame, especially here in America, where we have such a large footprint, for the human suffering that was taking place with the typhoon that hit the Philippines. This was right after that. And she said, if we are causing this and we are responsible, do you think that kind of direct connection can make that kind of difference? Because for those of us who do, have this awareness, it's frustrating sometimes to see perhaps the additional, destructive you know, quality of these storms, the higher fatalities, higher, more injuries perhaps. And I know you are quite known for saying we cannot tie any one weather event to climate change, but certainly we've seen a pattern, you know, the equivalent to a baseball player on steroids, where there's more carbon in the atmosphere fueling all these events, making it, you know, drier, wetter, stormier, windier, more destructive wildfires, all that. So is that something that you'd like to start seeing, or is that too much of a stretch to make those kind of connections when we are seeing events that, you know, over and over again you see witnesses saying they've never seen anything like this, never experienced anything like this, even though they've been in some of these areas for most, if not all, of their lives?
Well, you have to be a bit careful on this. When we're talking about extreme events, or something that's anyway rare to have a hurricane hit land when it happens to be at peak intensity the way Haiyan does, is that if you're not careful to really be scientifically correct in your assessment of whether or how much climate change played a role in it, you're wide open to the often very well-funded skeptics who can, in that case, rightly take you down and say, well, how do you know that was caused by climate change? You have to be careful about that. And, of course, what scientists like to do is they like to see enough statistics of extreme events to persuade them that there's really a trend before they're going to say anything about that. And, you know, I think the public is the same way, maybe not to the same degree, but I don't think that they, you know, one bad typhoon here or one bad wildfire there is going to persuade them. It's when they start to sense that the statistics are changing, and I think in some sense their bar is lower than that of a scientist, and when they're willing to say, yeah, you know, we're dealing with a risk. The scientists have been telling us that there are these risks. We can see these changes, maybe not at the level that a scientist would like to say it's statistically significant, but in the context of the predicted risk, it's enough of a risk that we should try to deal with it and not wait until there's absolute certainty, by which time it's probably too late.
Earlier this year, you and Peter Frumhoff of the Union of Concerned Scientists put out a great video basically encouraging people to come to the understanding that climate change is not a political issue and to have conversations across the political aisle with people who may or may not agree with you know, the seriousness of the issue. Do you see any sort of indications of optimism that perhaps the partisan divide on this is being healed somewhat? I mean, Betsy and I have talked about the Green Tea Coalition in Atlanta, which, you know, environmentalists and Tea Partiers are coming together to sort of, you know, embrace solar energy. There's also movements in Arizona to this effect. But do you still see, at least on a sort of local and statewide state, you know, in terms of individual state scale, if not a federal scale, finally a sort of coming together beyond red and blue towards sort of a green vision for the future?
Oh, yes, I'm very optimistic about that, particularly when you look at the longer term. It doesn't have to be very long, longer term history. I mean, on environmental issues, until quite recently, there was pretty strong bipartisan support and cooperation on them. I mean, the Montreal Protocol, which was a very important measure to curb the destruction of ozone, was signed into law by President Ronald Reagan, gladly signed into law. And believe me, we'd be in deep trouble now if he hadn't signed that. There wasn't much bipartisanship until fairly recently on this issue. And a lot of the measures that are still being talked about to deal with climate change, like carbon taxes, cap and trade, and so forth, came out of conservative think tanks. So there's a history of this. And I, maybe I'm being too much of a Dr. Pangloss here, but I think that what's going on at the moment with the Tea Party and this irrationality about it is probably just a blip, and it will go away. I mean, we're seeing signs of it. And we'll take the problem that we have with hurricanes in the United States, even without climate change. A lot of the problem we have, the terrific damages that hurricanes do, are due to, I think, demonstrably to the over-regulation of insurance in coastal regions. And conservatives can easily sign on to that. You know, maybe if we let insurance premiums float, we would discourage people from living in risky places. So I think as soon as people of different political persuasions can see routes to the solution to the problem that they like or at least can tolerate, that we'll start to do something about this.
And we realize, of course, you are an expert in science and you are an academia, but since we are wading a little bit into the political situation, do you have a thought or any opinion on John Podesta joining the Obama administration as an advisor, which will include his advice on climate change, even though we understand he's not going to be ruling on the very controversial Keystone project? And if you'd like to weigh in on that with your expert opinion, we'd like to hear that as well.
Well, I thank you for the invitation, but I feel I don't know enough about that situation to be able to comment on it very usefully. Sorry about that.
That would be John Podesta as opposed to Keystone. I imagine you have some opinion.
Yeah, John Podesta, that's right.
Yes, so what are your thoughts on Keystone? We've heard both sides, you are a voice of reason and ration and yet extremely knowledgeable about what's going on with climate science. So I hope it's okay to ask you if you have an opinion, if you can express it and share it. If not, we'll respect that too.
Well, I have an opinion that's a little bit off on the side about that, and that regardless of the technical merits and demerits of that proposal, that proposed pipeline, it's very important, I think, to get younger people engaged in this problem. And if that's a focal point for them, that's something concrete they can protest against. Whether or not that protest makes a lot of sense from a purely technical point of view may be beside the point. The fact is that it's a rallying point. I mean, I feel the same way about the movements at various universities, including mine, to divest from the big fossil fuel companies. If you look at the numbers, if all the universities did that, it wouldn't make a lot of difference to the oil companies. But boy, is it a good rallying point for young people to get involved in this. And that's where the value lies, I think, in the protest against these things.
Well, building on what Betsy had mentioned about the John Podesta association with Obama, you may have seen the piece that emerged on RollingStone.com and will be published fairly shortly in the Rolling Stone magazine from Bill McKibben, giving some vigorous criticism of President Obama's handling of climate change, basically saying that Obama is very good on rhetoric, but his real priority is continuing to, you know, drill, baby drill, and frack, baby frack. To which I would ask you, if Obama has indeed, as McKibben puts it, sort of been half-hearted about this, the question does have to be asked, is there any president or is there any one individual or any one political figure that could achieve meaningful greenhouse gas regulations? Is it simply a matter of a movement has to do that? Not one individual, not one elected official, not one president, not one senator, not one congressman, but a movement, a collection of people. In other words, can it be argued that McKibben is asking Obama to deliver something that politically it's impossible for either Obama or any other individual politician to deliver in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, it's a very interesting question. It's sort of a cat and mouse problem, right? You need both. You need to have widespread popular support for something, and you need to have leadership, and the leadership can certainly accelerate the process. And the delicate question for someone in the position of, say, the President of the United States is, does he have enough potential support that his leadership could make a difference, or will it just so weaken him to deal with other problems he has to deal with that it's not worth the fight? And that's a judgment call. I mean, I think it's something Lincoln had to face in deciding what to do about slavery, for example. That was at a time when there was a rapid evolution in public opinion, at least in the North, about that. If he had tried too soon, he might have failed. When's the right time to do this? And so the key, certainly everybody would agree on this issue, the key thing is to sustain movements to try to deal with the problem and to hope for the best we can get in leadership. On the particular point of fracking, it's a bit delicate because, of course, to the extent that you can shift from coal to natural gas, it's a very good thing to do in the short run, even while it's a very bad thing to do in the long run. You sort of want to encourage it as an interim thing, but to try to get rid of it afterwards as fast as you can.
And with all these, lesser of the evils, as we look at drilling for natural gas and some of the other things that are being explored and engaged in, is that all a sign quite clearly that we are running out of oil or past peak oil, in your opinion? Sometimes, I hear people doubt that that's the case, and then I say, well, why are we, drilling in the ocean out where the deep water horizon was? Why are we fracking, everywhere we can so quickly? It seems that we're, on the one hand, sensing some abundance of energy sources, new energy sources, certainly if you believe the commercials that are all over CNN, which is my network of choice, bright future for natural gas. And yet, if you read the messages from all the environmental activists that DR and I get every day, you think that not only is the sky falling, but the ground is shaking and we're having all kinds of problems already from the fracking, craze, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I would add to the motives to do it is the fact that a lot of our oil supply comes from political regimes that aren't necessarily stable or friendly, and so there's always been a desire for energy independence, which I think is driving this to some extent. But, it would have been wise for a leader like Obama to say, if they were going to make the decision to support this, to say, and by the way, we're going to put a lot of federal research dollars into research on carbon capture and sequestration, because that would have been a good thing. I don't see that happening, but if you're going to take more carbon out of the earth, the very least you could do is to try to promote research and development of ways of taking it back out of the atmosphere.
And speaking of leadership, this is a question that Betsy and I asked, I think it was of Jeffrey Sachs several weeks ago, and it's a similar question I would like to pose to you. Looking forward to the 2016 election, and with all this speculation about Chris Christie running for president and possibly getting the Republican nomination, do you think that we will see political circumstances by 2016 that will put Christie in a position where he will have to be forced to choose between a comprehensive approach to climate change and continued Severosa denialism? Our friend Brad Friedman, 2 years ago, as you may know, exposed the fact that Christie has more than a passing familiarity, so to speak, with Charles and David Koch. Do you think he might end up in a position, if we have more extreme weather events, where he'll have to, in order to mount a credible campaign for president, he will have to sort of divest himself of the Kochs and go back to the guy who, if you look at some of his past statements, at least to recognize the reality of the situation?
Yeah, I mean, it might very well be the case. I've often thought, being, of course, a complete amateur in this field, but that, if there's going to be a president who really does something about this, it might actually turn out to be a Republican, for the same reason that it took a Republican president to open up China. They're being aided by the fact that it's not perceived to be part of their ideology. My sense is that whatever he may do, that this Governor Christie actually gets it about climate change, and maybe he will, by the time that happens, if he should be elected, he will feel compelled to do something. My guess, and I'm sure you would agree with this, is that as we go forward in time, each successive administration is going to feel more and more pressure from the public to deal with this problem.
Hmm. And Professor Emanuel, we just have a couple of minutes left. So do you feel pressure as an atmospheric scientist? I don't mean political pressure here. I mean just as a citizen, perhaps as a father, to really, slow things down before we do go up a couple of degrees this century. I mean, that's what keeps hitting me over the head, is just how little time we have. And then even if we stop burning emissions tomorrow, we still have a lot out there that's going to be felt for the next 50 years. You're on sabbatical, so I don't mean to get you all stressed out about it, but I imagine even if you wanted to get away from this, you couldn't, since it is your area of expertise. You're very knowledgeable, rational, reasonable, and do you also have a sense, or are you just trained not to, of you know, we're running out of time here? And I guess part of me is in that question, at looking for some reassurance. So feel free if they're really, if we're over-responding when those of us who, you know, can't get away from this stuff as media, you know, can't seem to relax, I guess, and treat this as just another issue that we'll get around to.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm an educator. That's what I do. That's what I'm trained to do. That's what I'm perhaps reasonably good at. So I do feel, and I think a lot of my colleagues feel, that our educational mission is, at this particular time, especially critical, and that we have to reach out beyond just the classroom and try to educate as many people as we can about the underlying science, in my case, because that's what I do, that would allow them to make reasonable and informed decisions. That's why I'm spending my sabbatical working on a massively open online course on climate science. It doesn't deal with politics or policy at all. It's just science, hoping that we can reach a larger number of people around the world to give them the facts that they can then use to draw their own conclusions and do what they can do to try to solve this problem.
Hmm. Well, we are just about out of time, dear, unless you have any quick last question. And I'm glad to hear that, by the way, that you are working on that open website and information source. I was wondering if you're working on a book, and that would be welcome too, of course, but glad you're not just relaxing, and we need your input. That's why I say that, but certainly sabbatical, I'm sure, well-earned. DR, any last thoughts?
No, I just wanted to thank you once again so much for joining us. We definitely appreciate this, and you have certainly, in your terms of your writing, in terms of your research, in terms of your op-eds, the great op-eds you've written in the Boston Globe and other venues of the past several years, you've just done tremendous work in terms of educating people and enlightening people as to the reality of the scientific situation we're all facing.
And on that note, I just want to end by repeating this very dramatic last paragraph of this short op-ed you wrote for the Boston Globe. You say, in recognizing that the high side of the risk curve presents an existential threat to our descendants, we can take reasonable actions today to mitigate that risk, or we can gamble that the outcome will be on the benign side of the curve. True conservatives don't gamble with their children. Well put.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you both.
And have a happy holiday season and a great green new year. We'll be back with Scott Poranda. He is the head of the Dogwood Alliance, and he's going to be talking about a couple of their campaigns, including a new film they've done called Don't Burn Our Forests. And we'll be right back with that. Thanks, D.R. Tucker. Thank you again, Carrie Emanuel, for joining us. And thanks to the studio back in the PRN offices for a great year of production. We're not leaving. Got another 20 minutes of the show, but just wanted to say that. We will be away for the next 2 weeks, so we'll be running the best of, and that will be Christmas Day, New Year's Day. So I don't know if people will be out there listening, but we will certainly bring you our favorite shows from the last few months. We're going to be right back with a very important topic, and that is, why are we burning up wetlands for fuel?